Thanks, Dean.
Yeah, thank you, Dean. Am I close enough to this? Yeah, my name's Brian. I am an addict. I'm not without nerves, and I really enjoyed Alison. Thanks, Alison. then my head immediately told me Alison's good share took 15 minutes. So you bet. Why don't you just cut yours to 15 minutes? And 40, isn't it? And I'm thinking, But in the end, I'm such a chatterbox that Dean will have to stop me anyway, so I think I'll be all right. I worked today and I didn't think about, I was looking forward to coming here very much, but I didn't think about what I was going to say, and I haven't really thought about what I'm going to say. And that's a good thing for me, and it's a good thing for you, that I didn't pre-plan something. But I did get very nervous suddenly. I arrived at Waterloo. I come from down Richmond Way, and as I walked from Waterloo Station to here, I started getting anxious, nervous. And I rang my sponsor, and he's a man who has time for me, which is great, and usually a bit of wisdom. And he gives me usually 3 or 4 sentences, and he said, "What's up?" And I said, "Oh, I'm about to do a share in Trafalgar Square, and I'm feeling anxiety and nervousness." And unlike his usual stuff, he just said to me, "Listen, Brian, think about someone else and stop fucking thinking about yourself." I was mortally wounded. And you know what? He was right. Spot on. My anxiety is just self-obsession. We're all addicts. We're all sitting here, Narcotics Anonymous, because we're addicts. We can't have the first drug. I can't. And who the hell do I think I am? Do I even need to be nervous? I'm amongst my brothers and sisters, So. But my head can go, I'm a long time without a drug in my system, but I'm not a long time, without being insane thinking, And my feelings came up in the middle of, which is a good thing, in the middle of Alison's share, my feelings came up. And I thought, oh, there they are, the old feelings, they're coming up. They've been stuffed down all day in bullshit and work and, life, real life, for a good life. And but I realised what a bloody bullshit artist I am at times. I've eaten about 5 or 6 biscuits, and I ate something there called a wagon wheel. And I wouldn't have put one of those in my mouth since I was about 5. And I wolfed it down, I think I could do another one, And the reason I say I'm a bullshit artist is that I am not going to lie to anyone tonight. I have to say out loud, Brian, tell the bloody truth. I come from a very dishonest head, I'll tell you. Because today, I had a couple of women in my work situation. A couple of women I was working with and talking to, and I was telling them how I don't eat sugar. And they're super impressed. And, what, not at all, Brian? I said, nah. how bad sugar is? It's like a drug, sugar. In fact, it is a drug, I'm telling Mr. Expert. And there I was rattling away about not eating sugar. And the truth is I haven't. I've been given a miss. And so my nerves, my this, my obsession, I see you all over there. And I think, oh, that might make me feel better. So I'm sitting there eating. After only 3 hours since I'm telling these really nice women about sugar-free life. I have to go and make amends. So you're looking at a liar, and not tonight. If I lie, I'll buzz. I'll just go bzzz. If I tell you a lie, I'll call myself on it, because I can lie, I tell you. And so far I haven't. I'm quite impressed. And the dishonesty on the serious side of it, you know, I didn't know I was so dishonest. Even when I got clean, it took me a long time to understand what honesty was about. I was spent a big part of my life, a big chunk of my life in Australia, and but I was born in apparently off Kensington High Street, which sounds so posh. Kensington High Street. I only found out recently, by the way. I just found out six months ago or something, and I found out from my mother that I was born off Kensington High Street, you see. So I'm still grandiose, and I think as soon as I found out, I rang half a dozen people and said, I was born off Kensington High Street. And they're Londoners, and they said, whereabouts exactly? And I said, I told them where. And they said, yeah, that part was a shithole when you were born. You know, that Whole Foods and Kensington High Street, it's all very posh. And apparently, where I was born, it wasn't like that. So I stopped telling everyone I was born off Kensington High Street. And my parents were Irish immigrants, and they were decent folk. And the reason I love to talk about dishonesty is to never forget that one day at a time, I don't have to pick up, but also one day at a time, I don't have to be dishonest, because that's a big core, big part of me. So when I was five years old, my parents, due to my mother, they were middle class Irish. My mother was an Irish Mrs. Bouquet. She's alive, and she's 92, and she would probably hit me with an umbrella if she heard me saying she was an Irish Mrs. Bouquet. She had that thing about sort of class. You know, you think of the British with a class system. The Irish have got it too if they want to be. And they went to universities. But my mother, she fell pregnant to my father, and the way the two families handled it, unlike the 95% of the other Irish 60-odd years ago, they used to take the child off the mother and put them in the homes, in the Magdalen sisters and various homes. But the middle class and the other Irish, they would quickly get the couple and get them out of Ireland, pay for the families. So Labrick Grove, me and my mum, I just found out this all in the last few years. My mum got married in a registry office to my father while she was pregnant. And in Ireland, you know, 60-odd years ago, that was deep shame. Massive. I mean, it's like, you know, to this day, it can't be. You know, my mum's 92, and I can't talk to her about it. It's just bizarre. And I accept it in respect to her. I accept it. I don't want to live like that, but I accept that the shame is so big for her and the family that no one's allowed to mention it. And so she said to me when I was five years old, it was my first day at school. They'd left Labrick Grove area and moved to the southwest area, Putney, Barnes area, where I've ended up, ironically. And I never forget it. It's as if it was yesterday. She had her hands on my shoulders. I was in a beautiful little school uniform, day one, a bit scared. And she said to me, now, Brian, this is the first day at primary school. When you get to school, the other kids in the class, they might ask you, what does your daddy do? Now, him being an Irish immigrant, doesn't matter how well educated he was, there was prejudice. Labrick Grove, my dad showed me, he taught me to read and write, and my mum did taught me to read and write when I was about three or four. And I was this bright little boy, apparently, and showed me a sign in Labrick Grove in a newsagent's window, and it said, you know, flats to let, you know, kittens free, you know, bed for sale. And next to flats to let, it said, two-bedroom apartment, Labrick Grove. It said, no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. My dad said, read that. I read it. Oh, geez. I said, are we Irish, are we? He says, yeah, we're Irish. I said, And we moved, and they did better for themselves. But my dad, the best job he could get was in White City in a dairy. It's called United Dairies or something. And he worked there. Now, she had her hands on my shoulders, and she said, so when you're in class, first day at school, the boys and girls, they might ask you what your daddy does for a living. And I said, he works at United Dairies, because I used to love going there. I used to see all the milk bottles going around. The trains used to come in from the country to White City full of milk, dairy trains. It's quite interesting to me today. And they'd unload these big tankers of milk, and they'd bottle them. And I used to go there every fortnight. And my dad would give me, lots of kids used to go and see their dads, and they give you, you know, lollies or sweets, as you call them. And I used to like it. And he'd take me in and see all the bottles going around. And I said, no, Mummy, Daddy works in the dairy. She goes, no, he doesn't. I've been there about 15 times. And I was bright. And I said, no, he works in the, he doesn't. So what does he do then? She said, he might be a doctor, your daddy. He could be, you know, heaven forbid, a lawyer. He could be, you know, she made up all these. Dentist. Yeah. About a month later, I had been at school. They'd do that parent meets the teacher stuff and checking up on the kid. And they went in, and apparently my dad told me, they was called in. They said, Brian is fitting in really well. He's a good kid, but we're going to have to tone down his imagination. Imagination's good, but his imagination is like, you know. Well, every kid in the class adores him because his dad's an astronaut. So I loved it. If you lie, you get stuff. It's my mum really a good teacher, you know. And unfortunately, I don't blame my mother for that, but I was so powerful at 5 years old to look another kid in the eye at five, and their dad's a plumber, or you know, a respectable trade, or he's a doctor, doesn't matter what he is, and, you go, and yours, astronaut. You know. So I was like, Jesus, his dad's an astronaut. You know, and I had to stop doing that. And so dishonesty became a tool. So I lied where I thought it would be really, you know, useful. I didn't know that. You know. I had to learn all this in recovery. So tonight I'm going to be honest. Drugs, addiction. Funny you mentioned Tipex. We had something else, and it wasn't Tipex, but we found an equivalent. I'm going, you know, quite a few years earlier than yourself, in the 60s. And there really isn't a drug that I haven't tried, except these new modern ones. There's some new stuff around, you know. And I'm not as well as I think I am, because sometimes I'm reading about the new drugs that are coming out. And a part of me, I'm not saying I'm going to go on YouTube, but there is a part that sort of reads a bit more about it. I wonder what it actually does. And you Google, you know, on a bad day. I don't think about using, but I mean, there isn't anything I haven't really, I mean, except the modern ones that I don't know about. My final drug was, we didn't call it that, but it was what's called today crack cocaine. That's got me in here. And it was like bloody rocket fuel for me. I think we called it rocket fuel. But there's a long story before that, you know. It's, I guess, I can't, you know, I can't get away with not sort of mentioning that sort of cliche thing about feeling different. And I was actually quite a good kid at school. I was very good at sport, and I was okay, you know, wasn't. But I tell you what, I felt odd, right? Just deep down, and I mean deep down. So I was the class clown. I was quite bright. I was getting stuff, and I bought friends. I remember once I was very needy, you know, as far as needing attention from other kids. And what I did was, I remember myself and another guy, we robbed a place in Putney, at the back of a news agency, and we got everything we get our hands on and ran away and we escaped and didn't get caught. We were quite young, very young. And I remember everything that we stole, I took to school the next day and bought friends. Other lads, like, oh, he's the best rugby, he's the best this, he's the best that. And I was cunning, you know, sort of. Something was missing, you know, I needed much more attention. And really, right up until the end. Now, I had a couple of, I believe my addiction is very in line with mental illness, personally. I really do. Just my, speak for myself. Because I used anything to try and get away from that feeling. So it was fantasy I used everything I could, you know. I was joking about sugar, but I think I used to use that as a kid as well. But the first thing that really changed me, other than, you know, normal roots, alcohol and weed, and we had LSD in the 60s, and I tried that. And it wasn't really my go. I was like a hyper person, you know. But this dishonesty thing, I just want to tell the most important part of my story, because it's about, there's a way of getting clean in Narcotics Anonymous. There's 1,000 ways of getting clean. There isn't a blueprint to get clean. There is literature and the 12 steps, the higher power, and everything else. I came in here on step one and tradition three. In my teens, whenever I tried anything, I felt, oh, this is how I'm meant to feel. That's how I felt. And I just progressed from various things, and I still kept playing sport. I kept doing whatever I did. But the dishonesty was that I was frightened deep down of everything. I didn't know what. I was fearful. And I didn't have the guts to say, one thing I was good at was writing. I could write all day. As you can see, I could talk all day as well, but I'll move on. But because I could write, I didn't want to do what the rest of my brothers and sisters do, which is to go to university. I didn't think that would suit me. And at 15 in those days, much against my father's, mother's wishes, it wasn't against it, which they didn't know. I was so sick in that dishonest, lying, cheating, get my own way. Was I wrote to the Daily Telegraph in Fleet Street at 15. And they had five cadetships coming up. 200 or 300 kids got letters back. I was one of them. And then I got in, stuck in a room at the Daily Telegraph in Fleet Street, and I had to write a story. I wrote a story, and I was one of the five or six who got accepted. I was too scared to tell my parents that I had actually gone out on my own, got a job. This is how sick I think it's like a mental illness, is that I then wanted this job because I could write. Oh, Daily Telegraph's not particularly my favourite paper, but then it was a prestige, Fleet Street, that's bloody good. And what I did was, I put my school uniform on for my first day at work, walked out the front door, went to school. I went up to my mates up the road, he lived in a housing estate up the road, a lovely, really great mate. And he kept my work clothes in his house. I changed like Superman into work, go to Fleet Street, work in the paper. And I was coming home, get changed, school uniform. I did this for bloody weeks. And next thing, I walked in the front door. My dad was home early for a change. He used to get home late. And his sort of glum face said, "Brian, in the living room." And I went in the living room, and my mother was in there. She who must be obeyed, Mrs. Bouquet. And she had a smile, which is most unusual. My dad was a smiler. She was the, "Have a seat, Brian." And I sat down, and I was shitting myself. And I had a nice posh school uniform with a badge. And how was school today, Brian? I said it was good, Mummy. It was good. We used to call Mummy and Daddy. Yeah, it was good, Mummy. Oh, that's good. And my dad's going, oh God. Yeah. And so, Brian, what did you do? And I said, school. And I said, Tuesday we played rugby. Oh, how'd you go? Oh, we played Emmanuel. Did you? Yes. How'd you get on? Oh, good, we won. In fact, I scored a try. I'm just, you know, at this stage, I could see my father's face had gone from this lovely Irish red face to sort of grey. And she just held up a letter like that. And it was a Daily Telegraph letterhead saying, dear, you know, Brian, congratulations, you've got through the... So your writing is brilliant, you're going to go well. By the way, I wasn't a writer, I was making tea and coffee all day for real journalists, but I did do some work and I got in and I was accepted. And she goes, so how does that fit with school? And I'm sitting there in the school uniform. So the game was up and, you know, I couldn't, you know, I don't know how I handled it, but I think I told the truth, I didn't have any choice. I said, no, I've been working there and it's fine. That continued that time, and I couldn't live in that family. There was nothing really wrong with them. There was plenty wrong with me. But there was a lot. It was a tough family. There were five kids, father working in a factory, mum, she was working as well. And then I just lied again in Australia House next door to the Daily Telegraph as a Strand. I want to go to Australia. That's what I'm going to do. And all the people who worked in the newspaper said, Australians were working there, said, you're made for Australia, for some reason. You're made for Australia, Brian. You're in every sport. You're doing this. You're doing and I said, really? Oh, yeah, go to Australia. So I decided, I lied to go to Australia, because you could stay at the house. It was, come back when you're 21, and you can go to Australia, free of charge. It's good, 10 quid or whatever. And I kept pushing, and I got my own way in the end, and the guy in the end just said to me, listen, mate, you've got to stop coming in. I'm going to have lunch in a minute, and I'll explain something outside. And he explained to me, you can get there under 21 if you come from a borstal, a Dr. Bernardo's home, an orphanage, whatever. He said, but give it a couple of weeks. I went back. He said, don't come to me. I went back. I went to a woman. I said, oh, how can I help you? Oh, all Australian staff in Australia House. G'day, how can I help you? I said, oh, yeah, I'd like to go to Australia. And she looks at me, how old are you? I said, oh, I'm 15, you know, nearly 16. And she said, when you're 21, come back. I said, I'm an orphan. She said, oh, you should have told me. She said, oh, yeah. And so I get all this paperwork, fill it out, get everything done, and in no time, I'm on my way to Australia, lying again. My parents didn't try and stop me. And which hurt me, to be honest. It was an act of sort of like, I won't really go. They'll beg me not to go. They were like, what day are you leaving? and I went to Australia, and I had a sick ambition. You know, it was like, I was very good at sport. I'm into the rowing. I learned to surf. I'm surfing. I become an Aussie within 6-7 months. I'm like more Australian than the Australians themselves. So. All along the time, all along the way, though, is drug use. I'm picking up. But I have a sick ambition, and the ambition is never to work in a factory, like my dad, 60 hours a week for little money, and then watch him hand his money over to my mum. That's how they used to do it in the old days, to keep him away from me. He had a bit of a, he used to like the drink, so she took the money off him. And I said, I'm never going to do that. And so what my ambition was, I'll be a millionaire, that's what I'll do, and I'll go back there and show them. And I did all that. I married I was 17 in Australia, and a woman of 21 who became a wife, a fantastic woman. She said to me after two or three dates, she said, oh, Brian, I've got a bit of a feeling about you. And I went, oh, what's that feeling? She said, yeah, I think I'm in love with you. It was like three dates, you know. And I moved in with her the next day. No one had loved me. You love me? What? I said, yeah, I think I'm in love. That was it. Bang. I'm in. So I lived there. I'm a great woman. And we were to marry, and I've got four grown-up Australian kids now in their 30s. And bless them and bless her. Now, all the way through, I did become that millionaire. By 30, I was very successful in Australia. Is drug use, but I was socially using it. You know, it's just rubbish. Now I'm going to do
15 minutes.
Yeah, I'll better hurry up. Yeah, the sad part of it is that I detached more and more on a daily basis from that lovely woman. I lived in the same house. And those children, as my drug use went up and my success, now, I use success in inverted commas, material success. As that grew, and so did my drug use, and so did my insane behavior, just insane. And the main thing about me is that I always looked the part. I got away with it. That dishonesty from when I was five, I was still using these old tools, thinking they work. So I'm running companies and I'm investing in things. I started an airline. I mean, I became a multimillionaire. And it was tragic when I look back on it. And, you know, for drug use, for me, in the end, a scene that I don't like to recall very much, but I did put my kids, the classic sort of cliched thing, Sydney Harbour, waterfront home, beautiful children, good wife, and I've got the kids on the sofa, and this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. Your mummy and I don't get on anymore, and I'm going. I had my bags packed. I was going a mile away to an apartment because my living as a father and a husband was interfering with my drug use. And I moved out. I just walked away from put drugs first. This is hurting me more than it's hurting you, all that bullshit. My bullshit. I'm not saying anyone else. And those kids' faces changed, that shock of what? And I just went, and I had a nice place. But I doubled up my use and tripled up, I just went mad. Now, it's no coincidence that 27 years ago, it all came tumbling down. One business by business, airline went down, the business went down, everything went down. It all came, all the deck of cards crushed, crumbled down. Waterfront home went, all those lovely schools booted out, cars gone, everything gone. And I found myself, you know, thank God, in the rooms. The next part of my story is part that my sponsor says I should tell, because I'd rather not, because I've still got the people pleaser in me. I'm such a lovely guy sitting here. Most important part of my story is that I did find these rooms. But in Australia, they say when a horse thief walks into Narcotics Anonymous, he's still a horse thief. And I walked in as a horse thief. And I'm so full of shit sometimes. Even, apparently, a guy has told me at a King's Cross meeting in Sydney, at my very first NA meeting, a guy's told me that I was actually saying to people at the end of the meeting, listen, when you get a minute, I can probably help you out of the thing you were sharing about. At my first meeting, and they were going, he's fucking crazy, this guy. And, I was. But I was in. I was in. It's a long story, but I got to my first meeting 27 years ago, and I've never picked up a drug since. It's just extraordinary. I mean, even when I say it now, it goes boom. And what got me was what got me a little bit emotional when I came in here tonight. I got a few hugs, and I got, I won't get emotional, but my emotions are there. I'll try not to get emotional because I'd never actually been anywhere where I was really wanted. And in that sense of, no, we want you here, and we want you to come back again. It was unbelievable. And they're hugging. It was like, wow. I was blown away, you know. But the important part of my story is this. I was clean, as in not using, but the horse thief had come in to NA, and my head cleared. But, you know, and I'm an entrepreneur businessman, right? Doing loads of, I was just walking around Sydney going to NA meetings. That's all I was doing. I didn't know what else to do. I was doing 3 meetings a day. I was doing whatever I could. But I didn't get it. I didn't get the higher power. I left that part. I couldn't get the God thing. And I wanted to get back. My wife off my back. I want the kids back in nice schools. I want to get back to a waterfront home. And I had nothing. You know, I had nothing. So I just, you know, sat down, thought about it, didn't tell a soul. And I went to South America on a trip, and then Mexico. And I worked out how to get everything back again while I was in Narcotics Anonymous. And now, I'm not proud of that one bit, but I did do that. And I went to meetings in Mexico. I went to meetings in Peru. I went to meetings in Los Angeles whilst I was trafficking cocaine into Australia. So you do get your waterfront home back. You do get, NA is brilliant. You get a waterfront home back. You get the kids back in a nice school. The wife who you've left thinks they're actually quite a nice guy. You've delivered a new car. And here's the home again. And so I was a very sick person in Narcotics Anonymous in Sydney. I wasn't the only one, but there was, you know, I was doing it. And so I just did like any other business thing I'd done. And fortunately, I got caught. And I was arrested, and I'd been followed for a month. And I was arrested at gunpoint in Sydney by the equivalent DEA watching me. And I got banged up. Didn't get any bail. There's no bail. They judge just said, this guy is not getting bail. If you give him bail, he'll be gone within an hour out of the country. You've got to get a helicopter. And no bail. So I got sentenced, and I got locked up in the maximum security prison. And I was a couple of years in recovery, I tell you. And in that maximum security prison, I suddenly saw, for the first time ever, myself. You know, I'd never really seen. It was like I saw myself coming. What shit, you're going to be here for quite a few years. And a guy came up to me, who's to be my sponsor, and his name's Hawkeye, and he was like the equivalent of governor of the prison, but for the inmates. And he ran 4 Narcotics Anonymous meetings a week. He's a very tough man. He was doing a life sentence. And he said to me, Ryan, I hear you're telling everyone how you're clean. He said, did you a lot of good, didn't it, NA, and, you know, out there? And I went, well, I was a bit unlucky. I got caught, you know, nut. He said, I'm your sponsor. And I said, right. And he said, I'm also going to be your cellmate. So he moved in. And he's like, I didn't have any say in it. And he's big, tattooed, and, you know, 5,000 push-ups a day, weights. And he comes in, and the cells in Australia in those days were misogynistic. The walls were just full of pictures of women, basically. Or men, depending on what you say. And he came in with his crate and everything. He's moved in, and I was looking for the pictures. And he had all this stuff. He had the Serenity Prayer, and he had all Narcotics and all over the walls of our cell. And the first night in there was the night I got the message. It was he said, "You're on the top bunk, and don't talk to me tonight," he said to me. And I remember that. this is going to be a great relationship. And, but what did happen, I was on the top bunk, and I felt the bunk rattling. And I thought the obvious, you know. Oh, all right, okay, thanks. And, but truthfully, you know, I thought, what's going on down there? And I had to look over, and he was on his knees. He was praying. And I was like, oh, this is a bit uncomfortable. And he caught me looking like that. And he looked up and he said, "You can always join me, you know," like that. And I said, okay. And I, where it was God, like higher power, jumped in, because I couldn't get down there quick enough to have another man next to me praying, like, and meaning it. I'd never trusted that. And I got with him and I sat there and he just prayed. I felt like I was praying, I don't know what I was doing, but he then took me through. So we did a deal. I taught him to read and write. He couldn't read and write, but he knew more about Narcotics Anonymous than anyone I've ever come across. And he taught me humility, which I didn't know what it meant. And he taught me conscious contact, you know. And he taught me about love, actually. I mean, you know, love with your trousers on, I mean, that type of love. And, he taught me about love. And it was extraordinary. And I taught him to read and write. And then what we had there was about, he called it the raw material. Every day, about 12, 15 new inmates come into this maximum security. At least 10 of them are addicts, right? They always are, like, sometimes more, you know. And we would go and meet them on their first day in jail, and it's like a welcoming committee, and get them to come to the NA meetings. So I sponsored, if you look at it that way, hundreds. We would get them in, and they'd come. We did bribe them, you know, because we used to get priests to give us chocolates and things we weren't allowed on. We did have a little bit of a teaser there, and chocolates and various things like that. But they come to the meetings, and I truly understood it's one addict working with another that gets me out of my sick head, my sick thinking. And to finish the story off, I'm forever grateful to Hawkeye. I'm forever grateful for being caught. I'm forever grateful for those years I spent in prison. But at the end, I was to take a blow, and if I hadn't been clean, the way that I'm talking about, emotionally clean and mentally clean and physically clean, I couldn't have coped with it. Just before I finished, they grabbed me and said, bad news, the government of the prison was upset about it. I'd been in Australia 30 plus years, and I had those beautiful kids who came out every week for years to see me. They said, but we're actually going to grab you on the moment you're released. They're going to meet you outside, Brian, and they're taking you to an aircraft. And you're banned from ever coming back to Australia ever again. They used to send all the criminals out to Australia. And when they decided to start putting the quality ones, send them back again. So it nearly broke my heart. I make humor out of it, but the person I've got to thank as well is my first wife. She brought those kids out to the prison every weekend for years. She sat a few feet back from them, reading Marie Claire and magazines. I didn't ask. You have to have a relative to bring the children into maximum security, so it can't be a friend. And she just sat there. She's the one I thank the most. I've made amends to her in a very big way. And I arrived here in 2000 with 100 quid. That's all they gave me. And I start my life again. And the first thing I did was get to meetings over here. And you know what? I never felt lonely. I never felt lost. My heart ached over the children. But I rebuilt my life here, and I built a very successful business in London. And middle of that decade last year, I sorted out my ex-wife from working here, from 100 quid. All my kids are okay. I remarried again. I've now got a 13-year-old and 11-year-old. They're both about to turn into next age. And they don't know that Brian that I was talking about. They know a different father. My wife is half Indian, half Swedish. She doesn't understand addicts. I can't find any neurosis in her. It's very irritating. And I live this really good life. You know, amazing life I've got. But I've worked hard. I mean, addicts, we're clever bastards when we want to be. And in the right way. So I live an honest life. So I am a classic poacher turned gamekeeper. And Narcotics Anonymous is the foundation of that. You know, anything that I go to Bali on the 25th of December for a month or so with my Aussie kids, come to Bali because I can't get into Australia. So Bali's like the Spain out there. And we reconnect and we have amazing times. But I had to make amends to all, proper living amends. And it's extraordinary, you know. This is extraordinary. So it was the moment I threw the towel in. Brian's not in charge. There is a higher power after all. And I forgot there was a higher power 10 minutes before I came here when I was on that bridge, thinking, oh, what are they going to fucking think of me? You know, self-obsessed. It's gone now. It's gone out the bloody emergency exit. So I'm eternally grateful that I'm not in charge. My life. I do the footwork. But six kids I've got, six beautiful kids. Amazing. See, you know. And they don't judge me. They have a right to judge me, but they don't. They judge me positively. So, huge thank you to everyone who's got a bum and a seat in here tonight. And a big thank you to Ian asked me to do this here. Thank you, Ian. And thank you, Dean. And thanks to Narcotics Anonymous that there's not a lunatic out there trafficking drugs anymore. Thanks.